It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Gun Violence Archive reports that in 2023, more than 118 Americans died every day by firearms. And last month, the Surgeon General declared that gun violence is a public health crisis in the United States.
To talk about gun violence as a public health crisis, we have physicians from the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Stephen Hargarten is founding director of the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Hargarten, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Kate. Glad to be here.
At this moment, when we hear the Surgeon General declare gun violence a public health crisis in America, what is your reaction to this declaration?
Well, I think the first reaction is great that the Surgeon General is using his leadership position to call further attention to this vexing, tragic problem of the United States. And yet this has been a tragic public health problem for decades here in the United States. So yes, it's timely that he's come out to talk about it, and yet it has been needed to be discussed by the Surgeon General ever since the 90s. And the previous Surgeon General, C. Everett Koop, was, I think, one of the leaders who last discussed this. So again, timely and necessary, we need to do more.
The Surgeon General Vivek Murthy told the Associated Press that it's time to take the gun debate out of the realm of politics and instead talk about it in terms of public health. What can physicians do to shift public thinking around firearms?
It is no question that it's an adverse effect on the public's health. And we have other public health challenges that we face all of the time. And there are policies and issues that need to be discussed that place it in the political realm like other diseases have been placed. And so while framing it in the public health domain is very timely and useful for us to engage everyone, we recognize that policies have inherent need for political discussion and advancement. And so I think that's really important to understand the challenges that we have, both here in Wisconsin and in our nation, to really find a balance that we need from all sectors of civil society to bring us together, to find common ground, and to advance the health and safety of our communities.
Policies perhaps such as a 48-hour waiting period for purchasing handguns, which was repealed here in Wisconsin in 2015 by then-Governor Scott Walker. What does your research say about waiting periods?
So I think there is some research, not mine in particular, though we've looked at this, is that we know that the usage of firearms that are related to suicides are a significant problem and the major cause of firearm deaths here in Wisconsin. Over half are firearm-related suicides. And we do know that there are impulsive decisions about using a firearm for leading to a suicide. And so if there's a way to delay the acquisition of this product so that there is a cooling off period, if you will, if there's an opportunity to gain mental health treatments. We do know that means matter, and I think that policy should be reexamined for its benefit to the public's health, along with other kinds of policies that are involved with extreme risk protection orders that remove the firearm temporarily while that individual gains mental health treatment for whatever is causing their depression and anxiety and anger. So there's a lot of different programs and policies that can be and should be discussed in the light of the tragedies that are occurring most every day here in Wisconsin.
I want to get your take on Milwaukee's violence interrupters and de-escalating violence. The trauma center at Frederick has in-hospital violence interrupters, from what I understand. What impact do you see them making on this crisis?
Well, I think that this is a very, very strong example of how health systems are really thoughtfully engaging patients, in this case, who are wounded by a bullet. And when the patient arrives with a biomedical need, they're bleeding, they're in shock, they need the immediate actions of a surgeon to help save them from further injury. But during that moment, during the moment that they were shot, they're experiencing a behavioral injury, Kate. And that behavioral injury needs immediate therapy or immediate intervention to manage that injury so that it doesn't escalate into anger and revenge and retaliation, so that it doesn't end up being involved with the development of post-traumatic stress. And so the comprehensive approach that Frederick Hospital is doing, along with Children's, it is nationally recognized. It is nationally ahead of other trauma centers to comprehensively approach these patients in a way that provides them with comprehensive care and the likelihood of the unlikelihood of retaliation that leads to further injury and perhaps death. So it's a very important, very, very important and innovative program that you're referencing, Kate. And we need to fully evaluate it as it's being done as we speak. It looks like it's paying dividends.
Dr. Hargarten, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
That is Dr. Stephen Hargarten, founding director of the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And now let's turn to Dr. Megan Schultz, who directs the Global Child Health Program with the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Schultz, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
The Surgeon General's report says that since 2020, guns have been the leading cause of death for American children. What is causing the spike in gun deaths among kids?
Well, like so many public health issues, it's really multifaceted. I think 2020 was sort of a watershed moment for our country with the COVID pandemic. With the COVID pandemic, we saw a lot of safety nets and social structures really break down. Part of that was school, which so often provides a really nice structure and community for children. I think with school closures, that really hurt a lot of kids. You know, all of a sudden they were hungry. They didn't have a place to go. They weren't seeing their friends on a regular basis. Mental health issues have climbed since 2020 as well. I think that goes hand in hand with gun violence, as actually many of the gunshot wounds that we see in children are suicides or suicide attempts. So it's so multifaceted. You know, I think policy is definitely in there. There's just really unfettered access to guns in our country. So that's definitely part of it. But yeah, mental health, a lack of sort of investment in communities and structure for children, education.
What have you learned in treating these young patients who come before you? What have they taught you?
You know, I've trained first as a pediatrician. So I did my pediatric residency training first, and we don't learn about gun violence in pediatrics. It's not widely perceived to be a pediatric problem, or it wasn't 10 years ago when I was in pediatric training. So just from the medical clinical side of it, I've really had a trial by fire education on how to treat gunshot wounds in children. It's something I think no pediatrician ever envisions having to be able to do. But then also I think, you know, just as a mom, as a woman, as a community member, I have learned so much about how absolutely devastating guns are to entire communities, to families, to parents, to siblings. I mean, the amount of PTSD that we see in people who are maybe were not even shot themselves, but have seen someone shot, have seen a loved one shot, even being shown a gun, being threatened with a gun can cause PTSD. You know, it's something like 54% of U.S. adults or their family members have experienced a firearm-related incident. That was a huge learning point for me. Even when I'm not clinically treating a gunshot wound, I am dealing with the ramifications of them.
How should adults talk with their kids about guns? What should that conversation look like?
That's a great question, because I do think that this public health crisis requires all of us to respond. This is not just a policy issue for politicians to worry about. This is not just a medical issue for doctors to worry about. parents and adults and teachers and business owners need to be talking with, honestly, everyone in the community about guns, but especially children. So children are already getting some of this messaging through drills at school. So I think some parents I talk to are nervous about bringing it up, or they don't want to unnecessarily traumatize their children by talking about guns. But guns are omnipresent now. I mean, guns are in our culture. So kids are seeing guns on TV. They're playing with guns, you know, at the water park, like, you know, water guns. They mm-hmm. are, guns are in their video games. And then guns are in these school drills that every school does now. So how I talk to my kids about it and how I recommend parents talk to their children is, a gun is a very dangerous weapon. You can never play with a gun. If you see a gun anywhere, you need to go get help. Like, put it down, do not touch it, and go get a grown-up. We see a lot of gunshot wounds in Children's Wisconsin in the ER, who, it happens to children who have found a gun. Maybe they're at a play date and it's at a friend's home. Maybe they're at grandma's house and grandma bought a gun for protection. But a child who finds a gun sort of accidentally needs to know, needs to have the education that they cannot touch it. They cannot play with it. It is very dangerous.
Dr. Schultz, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Dr. Megan Schultz is director of the Global Child Health Program at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Earlier, we talked with Dr. Stephen Hargarden, who founded its Comprehensive Injury Center.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the project called My Brother's Keeper launched a decade ago with the goal of improving life for boys and young men of color. Now Milwaukee leaders are reviving their local chapter. We hear what they're up to. That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One decade ago, then-President Barack Obama called on community leaders to join together and commit to improving life outcomes for boys and young men of color.
The initiative was called My Brother's Keeper. In the last 10 years, it's grown to a network of more than 100 organizations around the country, including Milwaukee.
But Milwaukee's efforts to improve outcomes for black men and boys encountered roadblocks in the past.
Walter Lanier is president and CEO of the African American Leadership Alliance Milwaukee, or ALEM, and his organization is working to revive the mission of My Brother's Keeper in the city. Walter, thanks for joining us today.
I am glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about this My Brother's Keeper recognition for Milwaukee, what it means and what the goals are for this project?
Absolutely. It is both an older project and a newer project. Back when President Obama got into office, he launched My Brother's Keeper back in 2014-ish, right around that time. And then the city took on the charge of walking through and being a My Brother's Keeper city. There was a plan that came out of the city that was fairly strong and robust, and a good group of diverse people gathered together to make it happen. It ended up being, I would say, a little under-resourced, and they had staffing changes frequently. And so it almost launched, but never really quite took off. And then, so that's the older story. Then the newer story, a gentleman named MacArthur Antigua, who lives in Milwaukee, and he also was a deputy director with the Obama Foundation, reached back out to Milwaukee because we had a strong reputation in the My Brother's Keeper world, and also the Campaign for Black Male Achievement world. We were a city on the watch, a city on the move, and wanted us to jumpstart My Brother's Keeper. And so that's when we were charged and tasked to be the backbone organization for My Brother's Keeper and to get our region certified, which, as we said earlier, happened some months later. We were either the first or second city and the first combination of county city. So two things, the data part. First is to get certified. So that means we've gone through a rigorous process, identified teams, identified access, identified potential collaborations and partners on the journey. And we're certified with about 40 other cities and regions in the nation. The next step, which is a bigger lift, is to become a model city. And to become a model city, that means that we move population level data, big impact. And right now in the U.S., there are four model cities, Tulsa, Yonkers, Newark. I always forget the fourth one. But two of those cities have moved population level data on homicide rates, and two of those cities have moved population level data on education goals. And so our goal is to move metrics and to become a model city by working collaboratively to move population level data.
And I wanted to ask about some of the challenges you're looking to tackle with this ongoing project. When you look at numbers, things like educational outcome, health disparities, and more, Wisconsin, by a lot of the numbers, not a great place for black boys and black men. Same true in Milwaukee specifically. What do you see as the biggest challenges, the biggest needles you're hoping to move here?
Great question. A couple things I'll say. We at ALIM have commissioned an index of African-American well-being that was created and put together by Dr. Mark Levine, UWM Center for Economic Development. The first one came out in 2020. The next one will be coming out soon. He used 30 different data points to evaluate African-American well-being against 50 different cities. Hispanic Collaborative of Greater Milwaukee has a similar index as well. Unfortunately, we were at the bottom 50 out of 50. So painfully, the worst place to be black in America. So that's real. That's a rough data point. It has not shifted. So that's bullet point number one. Bullet point number two, there are a few things that Dr. Levine, when he compared to other cities, said would make a significant difference. One is to grow and elevate black leaders. And that is something that ALIM has been doing for 15 years. So that's a significant lever. And the second significant lever that he mentioned is improving educational outcomes. And so we have a particular focus on educational outcomes. We're also looking at employability and violence reduction. But the first one that we're hoping to move on is educational outcomes, decreasing dropout rates, increasing graduation rates are great starts in that area. And also a nice thing about that is the original city plan had some great metrics around education.
Let's zoom in there then on education for that, say, middle school or high school student. What kind of things might you be doing to reach out to them and help them stay in school, have that successful graduation outcome?
So you're going to hear me name a lot of names because we have a lot of partners and collaborators. And I will say in the model cities, that was their distinctive, the ability and history of working together for a long time together is what allowed them to make moves. So for example, Yonkers, their graduation rate for students of color in the K-12 city system is 91%. Newark, New Jersey closed their homicide rate by 55%, all in particular because they work together across cultures, also across silos and across bureaucracies. So here in Milwaukee, we work with our data partners, Marquette University Center for Urban Research, Teaching and Outreach, and they've been gathering data on programming for boys and men of color for some years with some funding that came out of the city of Milwaukee, a Black Male Achievement Advisory Council. And so when we talk about closing gaps in education, that's improving graduation rates and also decreasing dropout rates in high school. And then, of course, matriculation rates and graduation rates in college. We have some great skeletons in place in the city. One of the best, I say skeleton because it needs to be animated more, is M-Cubed. M-Cubed is a maybe 6 years old. It is UWM, MATC, and Milwaukee Public Schools. And they've pulled together to try to improve educational outcomes coming out of that ecosystem. I call it an ecosystem because the largest number of students that graduate from MPS that go on to college either go to MATC first, second highest is UWM. So there's a natural flow there. Well, one of the things that we're encouraging in that particular initiative is that there be more attention being paid to some equity goals and also to student voice, so that that pre-existing system of opportunity for boys and men of color is more visible, more transparent, more accessible, more palatable, you know, so people see it as a legitimate, substantive, robust, doable pathway. And we believe that that will decrease dropout rates, increase graduation rates, and make that system more effective for boys and men of color.
And Walter, talking about partnership is really interesting. I've been talking to people in Milwaukee and other communities for years, and I hear the same story again and again. We've got great people doing great programs. They're really devoted. Their individual thing is fantastic, and they're all alone, right? They're not combining their efforts. They're not working together. If I'm reading you right, this is part of your vision, your goal is to say, let's take all these great threads and weave them together.
Yeah, if you know, and you don't, but if you knew me and you get to know me, you know, my hashtag is always build community. And then my metaphor is basketball. My father is a former NBA Hall of Famer, Bob Lanier, who passed away in 2022. Yeah. And so basketball, you learn all about how to play together effectively and to maximize everybody's gifts and talents. In Milwaukee, because we've been so segregated and siloed, not just across race, but also across industries, we need to grow in our culture of working together, not only because it's the right thing to do, but there are actually synergies to be captured that we miss out on. There are innovations and bright ideas to be captured when we work together effectively. However, our history is that we have these segregated and siloed habits. And myself and Bevan Christie, who's been the coordinator for our MBK efforts, we're on these community of practice calls, and we keep saying, well, what does Newark have that Milwaukee doesn't have? What does Yonkers have that Milwaukee doesn't have? And it's really, for the most part, nothing. But they have a longer history of working together, and that makes a difference. I'll give a quick example. Mm-hmm. In Newark, here in Milwaukee, when we talked about violence reduction, there were some tensions between the police department and what was then called the Office of Violence Prevention. They were bumping heads, some finger pointing, et cetera. Conversely, in Newark, New Jersey, the police department actually took a piece of their budget and gave it to the Office of Violence Prevention in Newark in order to work together towards a common goal. And we need more of that. And that is the difference.
Walter Lanier is with us from the African American Leadership Alliance in Milwaukee. We're talking to him about My Brother's Keeper Milwaukee. It's an effort to tackle opportunity gaps, improve life outcomes for young men and boys of color in Milwaukee. Walter, one of the reasons we reached out to you, we'd heard a while back from a listener who's involved in a mentorship program. I think it was called Boys to Men. That's now part of this My Brother's Keeper wider effort. Can you talk about the role of mentorship in tackling all these different goals you have, for especially for young Black men?
Mentorship is huge for a lot of reasons, symbolically and substantively. When I say symbolically, you know, if you get an opportunity to see somebody do something you haven't done before and you want to do it, then it gives you a better idea of that it's possible. So that's a very low level. I was at a meeting a couple weeks ago, and a younger attorney, younger than me, Jason Allen, who's a partner now at Foley and Lardner, he reminded me of when I met him maybe 30 years ago when he was in law school, and I was a young lawyer at Michael Best, then Michael Best and Friedrich. And he said when he interviewed with me, I was one of the first times he's seen a Black attorney in a large law firm, and that gave him some insight and belief as to what he could be. I hadn't thought about myself as fulfilling that role and function for him, but I did. So that's kind of what I call the symbolic or the presence, the dynamic of others who've done what you want to do. And then second, here in Milwaukee, with all the challenges we have, navigating systems, navigating organizational cultures, navigating self and learning how to move forward and accomplish goals, It's tough to do it on our own. It's different if there's somebody that's been there before us who can pass on some words of wisdom, some instruction, some direction, some correction. And so we know the data tells us that mentorship is very, very important. I'm appreciative of the program you mentioned, Boys to Men. I also mentor Greater Milwaukee with my good friend, Lidonel Ramey, former director of the Milwaukee Public Schools Black and Latino Male Achievement Department. And so I know, and I certainly know young men of color and young African-American men in particular, when we have mentors, when we have people in front of us who we can aspire to be, it makes a big difference.
One of the My Brother's Keeper priorities is, to, I'm going to quote here, protect the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual wellness of boys and men of color.
Yes.
Can you talk us through kind of on the ground level? It's kind of a wide mission there. What kind of things can help accomplish that?
That's very robust. We have a narrative change project that we're working on to change the narrative around Black life and leadership in Milwaukee. And one of the burdens of being Black in Milwaukee is that sometimes we fall prey to being a stereotype. And you can feel the weight of that. If you leave Milwaukee, if we go to other cities, for example, people will ask, well, are there any Black people in Milwaukee at all? Or they will look at only negative statistics. And so there's a truth about being a Black male, Hispanic as well, that often in cities that have not celebrated diversity, you are Black or brown male, you will be viewed as a negative statistic. And that's just a weight and a burden that is carried. And so I lift that one up first, because it's easy to point to principles of grit and resilience, and those are equally important, but we also have to give it context. We have to recognize we're in a city, in a place that has not had a great relationship with boys and men of color, notwithstanding that we're fortunate now to have two young millennials as our mayor and county executive. So that's about, you know, looking at the system and being aware of the system, one. And then two, there is, how do you navigate stress? How do you navigate pressure? If you happen to be in a environment that's unhealthy, how do you navigate that? And that's, now I'm stereotyping a little bit, but stereotypically for men, you know, we're raised not to cry, to be tough, not to complain, not to be concerned, not to show weakness. And those are good for survival, but they're not good for thriving, because to thrive, I need to be able to talk about my full range of emotions and get access to resources to support my mental health and well-being.
Walter, I think it's easy for someone to see a problem in their community and think, I hope somebody fixes that. What led you personally to say, ask yourself, I guess, what can I do to be part of the solution?
Yeah, you know, I it's part of who I am. It's part of who I got from my parents. My father, always, even more so than basketball, he always talked to me about making a difference, making an impact. Who did you touch today? What impact did you have today? My mother is the same person and personality. She's still with us, one of the founders of Legacy Bank. And so when I left for law school in 1992 and University of Michigan and graduated in 95, I chose to come back to Milwaukee, one, because we had two young kids and I wanted to be around parents, but also because I wanted to serve and I wanted to make a difference and have an impact. It's just a part of who I am. And, you know, what better place to have an impact than in Milwaukee, where I knew the statistical challenges way back then in 1995. And so it just is fundamentally a part of who I am. My goal, my vision, my belief, my plan is to do as much as I can to make a difference in this city, both individually, but also systemically, so people can be liberated and have the best life that they can have. Everybody deserves it.
Do you feel hopeful? Do you feel like you've got momentum here and things are going to improve significantly for Milwaukee?
I do. And it's not a naive hope. It is. I believe in the power of the collective. And I believe our collective has been undervalued and under-resourced. And I mean that in a very abstract way. And so I know from a team perspective, an organizational culture perspective, as teams work together, as talents work together, they start to make 1 + 1 = 3 and 1 + 1 = 4. Those are synergies and innovation, and that's understated for our city right now. A segregated city, in my view, I've thought this for a while, cannot help but have a level of mediocrity in it because they don't know what excellence looks like. They don't know what it looks like to thrive together. So that's our condition. The flip side of that condition does not require a massive infusion of resources, although we take all we can get, but rather it requires intentionality and perseverance. The talent is here. If you look out into our communities cross-culturally and you try to identify a talent or a skill, you will not find many that we don't have. We have a diversity of talents and skills and gifts and abilities here in our city. And as they work together more effectively, I think we'll be very dynamic. We got to rise above the petty. Have to rise above traditional divisions that are not fruitful and often not substantive. I think they're usually a lack of relationship. Even the left, right, or the red, blue political divides, if we want to be excellent, we will only be able to do it together. And I think there's a willpower to make that happen. I just think we need to do it more effectively.
Walter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, awesome. Glad to be here.
Walter Lanier is president and CEO of the African American Leadership Alliance Milwaukee. We talked with him about My Brother's Keeper, an effort to address opportunity gaps and improve life outcomes for young men and boys of color in Milwaukee.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, have you ever seen an island move? If you live near the Chippewa Flowage in northwestern Wisconsin, you might have. We hear from one community that needs to move bogs in the river every year. That's coming up on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a common yet intriguing animal in western Wisconsin.
No matter where we live in Wisconsin, we share our community with birds. Writer Ron Davis of Eau Claire has been thinking a lot about his feathered neighbors lately, particularly the crows.
Sawdust City, Portland of the Midwest, and horseradish capital of the world. These are just a few of Eau Claire, Wisconsin's nicknames, but I've come to increasingly think of it as the Crow City. Is it just me? It seems that anywhere I go, there are crows, sometimes lots of crows. I hear them throughout the day, particularly at dawn when they begin rallying up for the day's quest for food. Some spilled French fries in the McDonald's parking lot, that squirrel pancaked on Water Street, or maybe a few squished blueberries from the farmer's market. But don't get me wrong. Apart from the raucous reveille in the mornings, I've got nothing against crows. True, the American crow is certainly not as glamorous as Eau Claire's famous eagle, Old Abe. Their caw can't be described as a song. And thanks to those haunting scenes in Alfred Hitchcock's adaptation of The Birds, crows even have a sinister repute. But I found that your basic crow actually has some pretty amazing qualities. I was recently birdwatching in Carson Park with Steve Bechkol of Eau Claire. He's an ornithologist, Emmy-winning video journalist, and author of 8 books on birds.
Well, if you're a fan of bird behavior, then you're a fan of crows.
I learned crows are one of only 4 species, including humans, that can fashion and use tools. Crows have the largest brain-to-body ratio of any bird, even bigger than ours, and the lowly scavenger has sometimes been called the chimpanzee of the bird world. Research indicates they can count as high as 16.
One of the reasons that crows are so successful is because they're so adaptive. They're omnivorous, so just about anything that has caloric value is fit for consumption. They're also not picky about habitat. They do require trees for nesting or roosting, but they're just fine if those trees are next to human habitation. Additionally, crows aren't migratory, so they don't face the kind of stressors that long-distance migrants do.
Crows are also very social and family-oriented. They mostly mate for life, and they often help raise fledglings for other crows' broods. Crows have their own language of more than 100 different calls, even different regional dialects. According to Bechko, crows can even tell us something about ourselves.
Every bird is a success story, an example of a species that has been shaped over millions of years. And birds are indicators of environmental health. If the birds aren't doing well, that's a good indication that we're doing something to hurt their populations, and the data bear this out. Species that, unlike crows, are more sensitive to habitat disruption, free-roaming cats, migratory stressors, and environmental toxins are not doing well. Perhaps we should take a closer look at human behavior.
After living in the sticks for 40 years, I moved to Eau Claire 5 years ago. Besides the crows, I delight in any incursions of wildlife into my new neighborhood, whether it's the deer that sneak into our backyard at night or the squirrels that terrorize our bird feeders.
Eau Claire is, of course, a bird city, and that designation is beneficial for community. However, it's not a one-way deal, in my opinion. We owe birds something in return, a commitment to more conscientious and sustainable lifestyles, which are bird-friendly. There's data out there that says that half the humans on Earth are born with a genetic propensity to love animals. What does that mean for the other 50%, I wonder? And how does that translate into everyday practice of compassion and empathy?
The crow may not be Eau Claire's official city bird, but perhaps any touch of wildlife in this city is something worth treasuring.
Ron Davis is a writer who lives in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Picture the scene. You're out on a lake and you see an island. Good size, lots of plants, maybe even some trees on it. Then you take a closer look. The island is moving.
That's a real-life scene on the Lake Chippewa flowage in northwestern Wisconsin, not far from Hayward. The islands are actually wetland bogs that drift slowly around the flowage.
Sometimes the bogs block off key waterways, and a group of community members get together to move the bog with their boats.
They're known as the Bog Pushers.
Cheryl Treeland is president of the Lake Chippewa Flowage Resort Association and retired owner of Treeland Resorts. She's one of the main organizers of the Bog Pushers. We started by talking about a bog the group recently moved. It has mature trees and weighs an estimated 200 tons.
It moves because the water is real high and because the winds are moving it. Once it gets moving, you can move it right along. When we moved that bog a couple weeks ago, we had probably 40 to 50 boats on it. And we were being directed with people with radios, and we had it three sides of it surrounded, and we were going great guns, and we had moved it probably, when it starts moving, you can actually see it moving. You're like, wow, you look at the shoreline, and you see that you are actually moving it, and you're making progress. Well, then a big gust of wind came up and deflated everything for us because it spun it around a good 30, 40 degrees from where we needed to take it through a channel to get it through, and we got it hung up on a rock bar. So it sat there for almost 48 hours. And then we had another big storm two nights later, and that one blew out, and it's now over in a place that is no longer a navigation hazard.
Wow. Now, Cheryl, I want to ask, if I was out on the water in the flowage there, and I didn't know about these floating bogs, right? And if I looked at this one, like, especially this big one you talked about moving, I would think it's an island, right? I mean, plants and trees and stuff, it looks to the untrained eye like an island, right?
It does look like an island. People call them floating islands all the time, but they're not actually island because they're not land.
Right.
What you can do when you look at them, there's never a shoreline on a bog. There's never, as you look at an island, you typically see the topography going away from the shoreline. You know, you're going to get to the shoreline as you go further back away from the shoreline. You see the trees getting higher. You might see, you know, higher off in the distance. When you look at a bog, everything is flat. So the trees, the bushes, everything's going to be the same level. As you look back at it, there's no topography, no change in the elevation, and there's never a shoreline unless it's washed up onto a shoreline but the bog is not part of the shoreline.
And you mentioned a navigation hazard. If these bogs blow over to the wrong place, they can literally cut one part of the lake off from another part?
Yep. The Chippewa flowage is about almost 16,000 acres of water. We've got 140 islands out there, and we've got over 200 miles of shoreline. We have only one spot on the whole Chippewa flowage, which is the bridge, which is right centrally located, north, south, east, west, is where the bridge is. And that's where these bogs are. They are on the west side. If they get blown in to the bridge, we become two lakes. All right. And everyone is so used to, even though it's a large lake, everyone's used to it, the size of outboards and stuff. Now, you know, if we were going back 50, 60, 70 years ago, it would not be the issue that it is, because people weren't leaving their resorts, their vacation homes. They were not leaving and taking off and going, you know, 15, 20 miles across the lake. Nowadays, everyone hops in their boat, and what used to be an all-day trek and, like, you know, trip to the Antarctica or something, when people left the resorts to make it down to the dam and back, it was an all-day affair. And when they left, everyone wished them good wishes. They'd stop and have a shore lunch somewhere, but, you know, they're looking at maybe a 10-horse motor at the biggest, and they'd have three, four people and all their gear for the day in there, and they'd make it back, you know, before dark, and everyone would be down there to greet them. Did you find it? Did you find it? And all of this stuff. And it was quite different. Nowadays, with all of the boats and the size of the motors, it's, even though the lake is large, it's made the lake a lot smaller.
When you need the bog pushers to swing into action, how is there a bat signal, or what do you do to get people out and rallied and have their boats ready to rock?
Well, I retired in 2000 from being a resort owner. And so the first time after that we had to move the bog, I got a call from Denny, because he's got the landing, which is right by the bridge, and he's the one that is affected by it, because he's on the west side in just north of the bridge, and the bogs really affect him. He can see it on a day-to-day, minute-by-minute. He can watch what's happening with bogs. And he says, Cheryl, because it was on, you know, an early Saturday morning, he says, the bog's blocking the bridge. He says, can you do something today? Because resorters on Saturdays don't have any extra time at all, because it's a big changeover day. So Denny, I said, yep, I'll take care of it, because I was retired now. I wasn't cleaning cabins and checking people in on Saturday. So I got on the phone. I just started calling other resorters, leaving messages there. I called campgrounds, left messages there. I called people on the property owners that are on the lake. And you just say, hey, we're going to meet at, I said, give me a time. He says, 3 o'clock today. I said, okay. So I just start putting the word out. Okay, 3 o'clock today, bring any boats you can. If you don't have a boat, come by car, stand on the bridge, because what we need to do when we push, we have to have weight in the front end of the boat so the boats don't just skid up on top of the bog, okay? So we get people that just, they wander down there, they become part of the bog pushers, and it becomes a big social event. We can have this one Tuesday a week ago, I think we had probably 40 to 50 boats there, and we probably had at least another 50 people that just showed up and bail into the boats so that we can hold down the nose of them as we start giving power to it to try to push it.
I love it. So I could, if I don't have a boat, I can show up and be ballast.
You better believe it. You would be up in the front end, and you'd be just sitting there as we're going very little or nowhere. When we moved it a couple years ago in my boat, I looked down at one time. I said, we're actually going 0.7 miles per hour. And the guy who was next to me with his fishing boat with all the gadgets on it, he looked down, he goes, that's exactly what I have, 0.7 miles per hour. So it doesn't move fast, but when you're looking at shore, you can see that you are moving it, and you know that it is going somewhere. But you got to have, the winds have to be right, water levels have to be right.
Talking to Cheryl Treeland, president of the Lake Chippewa Flowage Resort Association, about the floating bogs on the Lake Chippewa Flowage. Got to ask you, Cheryl, about the fishing there. Now, you have served as the Grand Marshal of Muskie Fest there, and some world record muskies have been caught. There's a little controversy. Can you tell us a little bit about muskie fishing in the flowage?
Well, muskie fishing is the world record fish caught by Louis Spray in 1949. It was 63 and a half inches long. That's 5 foot, 3.5 inches tall, just about what I am. And with 69 pounds, 11 ounces. I weigh a little bit more than that, though. Anyhow, that was one that was caught there. We also had some, Al Johnson caught a world record prior to that, that was the world record out of Lake Couderay, another lake right up here close to the Chippewa flowage. And but we have great fishing, great fishery out here. We have a lot of, the size limit is now 50 inches. And just about everyone in the muskie world now, everything is CPR, it's catch, photo, and release of these fish, and they're just fishing for the sport of it. So you're starting to see a lot of fish every year. We probably have, I'd say, about half a dozen that are caught that are over 50 inches that they're getting into the boats and CPRing and releasing. And but the fisheries are great muskie fishery, and we have several muskie tournaments here. This over the last year, they had the professional muskie trail tournament. Their final championship for the whole season four was on the Chippewa flowage, and that was a very, very well fished, well tournament, good tournament for them because they did bring in lots of fish.
I got to ask a bonus question here, Cheryl. I distantly remember my teenage years. Me and my buddies didn't always have great judgment. I could see if we had a floating bog like this in the local lake, us going out and trying to, you know, hop out and, you know, hang out on it or something, which sounds like wouldn't work. Do you ever get people going out and thinking they're going to have a picnic or whatever on this floating bog?
No.
No?
You would pull up to it. They're great fishing areas. As you get towards in the morning or in the evening, you see boats pull up to the bogs and they just grab some of the branches that are there from like the brush that grows on it, and they tie their thing there. But because the bog is floating, it's always moving. So if a boat goes by, you see kind of this ripple effect of the whole bog as it moves up and down. But when it does that, all this stuff that's in the bog and underneath all the branches and everything underneath it that are underneath the water, it's great protection for the littler fish. You have the little stuff that falls off of the bog all the time, which is feed for the fish. And you basically, they're great fishing areas. But if you tried to step out on them, your foot, you'd go right down into a mass of tangled roots, black muck, and it would not be fun. If you had to get onto it, what you would probably do is get a pair of like water skis on, get the bindings as big as you could get them, keep your tennis shoes on, and then that's enough to hold you up on top of the brush. If it's a developed bog, if it's a new bog, you wouldn't even do it with a, you know, there's a mud flat. I wouldn't want to do it even with the skis on.
Cheryl, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
You betcha. Thank you.
Cheryl Treeland is president of the Lake Chippewa Flowage Resort Association. She's one of the main organizers of the Bog Pushers.
So a while back, we talked about the growing list of two-year UW campuses that have closed or announced their closure in the coming years, and we asked you to share your experiences.
Carol and Marinette texted us and writes, "My son did his first 2 years of college here in Marinette, as did many of his friends. That was much more convenient and affordable for us. UW Marinette is now closed. Unfortunately, this closure, like the others across Wisconsin, will likely make a college education financially out of reach for many." Carol says, "The Marinette campus also hosted a large number of foreign exchange students. That diversity is now lost to us. The closure of the Marinette campus came as a shock to us. Losing it is tragic."
Carol, thank you for sharing that with us. And you can share your feedback on this or any topic we cover here in Wisconsin Today. Call or text us, 888-642-0232, or you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.